Frog, and this is VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Susan Shand, and Dan Novak. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Most wild mushrooms collected in Germany in recent years still showed radioactive contamination from the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. But the country's Food Safety Agency says most samples did not contain radiation levels above legal limits. In 1986, a reactor at Ukraine's Chernobyl Nuclear Power Center exploded and caught fire. The accident, the world's worst nuclear disaster, sent huge amounts of radiation into the air. It sent radioactive particles across large parts of Europe. Investigators at Germany's Federal Office of Consumer Protection and Food Safety, or BVL, tested many different kinds of mushrooms. They measured levels of two kinds of radioactive isotopes, cesium-137 and cesium-134. The isotopes are byproducts of the production process in nuclear reactors. Of the mushrooms tested that are marketed to humans, none contained levels above the legal limit of 600 becquerels of radiation per kilogram, the BVL reported. A becquerel is a unit of radioactive measurement. Some additional mushrooms that grow in the wild were tested and shown to have levels above 1,000 becquerels of cesium-137 radiation per kilogram in the last 3 years, the country's Office for Radiation Protection reports. It urged individuals seeking to limit radiation exposure not to self-pick wild mushrooms in affected areas. The agency noted, however, that even if a person ate 200 grams of mushrooms with 3,000 becquerels of cesium-137 per kilogram, this would be about equal to the radiation exposure received during a flight from Germany to Spain. Higher radioactivity levels in mushrooms were found in southern Germany, especially in southern Bavaria and the Bavarian forest, the BVL said. Officials said the radioactive material stays in forests so long because those environments recycle nutrients very effectively. This means that wild mushrooms show contamination levels for much longer periods than other agricultural products. Concern about the long-term effects of nuclear disasters has fueled public opposition to nuclear power in Germany. The country decided to halt its nuclear power industry in 2011. Shortly after the accident at Japan's Fukushima Nuclear Power Center. I'm Brian Lynn.
Japan's famous Wagyu beef can cost more than $400 for a kilogram. Now, however, it may become less costly as scientists plan to introduce a lab-grown copy. Japanese scientists say they have recreated Wagyu in a lab that may taste and look exactly like real meat. Wagyu is famous for its fat content, which spreads throughout the meat, and the fat gives the meat a special taste. Wagyu beef comes from a kind of black cow raised mostly in the Kobe area of western Japan. Osaka University researchers used 3D bioprinters and stem cells from cows to recreate Wagyu's fat content in a single piece. Earlier attempts tried to recreate the meat by joining many pieces. The research was led by Michiya Matsusaki. You will not, however, be eating it anytime soon. Right now, it takes nearly 4 weeks to create a cubic centimeter of the meat. Matsusaki explained that as techniques and efficiency improve, the researchers may be close to making it a real food possibility. If we are able to quickly produce a lot of meat from a few cells, there's a chance we can better respond to food and protein shortage issues in the future, he told Reuters. Both environmental concerns and other issues in the meat industry have pushed interest in lab-grown meats. There is also a strong interest in plant-based meat, such as those made by Impossible Foods, Inc. Matsusaki said that bioprinting and lab-growing techniques may have their uses in other areas, such as growing replacements for damaged human muscles. It now costs about $90 to create a small piece of Wagyu. Matsusaki said that price will come down, and the meat may be on dinner tables within 5 years. I'm Susan Shand.
Students in English as a Second Language, or ESL, programs are a large and growing population in American schools. The U.S. Department of Education says that the number of ESL learners increased by more than 1 million from 2000 to 2020. That is about 10% of all students in the country. In states like California and Texas, nearly 20% of students are English learners. But English learners are everywhere in the country, notes Leslie Villegas. She is an education researcher with the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C. Her recent study looked at the percentage of ESL students within each state, as well as the most common languages spoken at home for those students. As the number of English learners grow, there is a need for more ESL teachers. But the U.S. is dealing with a nationwide teacher shortage across all grade and subject areas. And in the next few years, experts expect the shortage to get worse among English language educators, Villegas said. Josie Gutierrez is the assistant superintendent of the Waco Independent School District in Texas. She said the teacher shortage has slowed down the growth of the district's bilingual program. There has been an increase in state and federal pandemic aid to schools. So money is not the problem, Gutierrez noted. But the supply of teachers has not increased. And schools are vying for the same supply, she said. School districts know that ESL teachers are often in short supply. District leaders often try to improve and increase their recruiting efforts. Grace Benson is the director of ESL and bilingual education of Waco Schools. She said, "Being in ESL and bilingual education, I am always recruiting, even when we're not in a pandemic, just because bilingual education as a whole is under a shortage." Benson said she has been able to fill almost all ESL positions for this school year. In Austin, Texas, the city school district requires all elementary school teachers, as well as middle and high school English teachers, to be trained in ESL instruction. Assistant Superintendent Destiny Edwards said that is a large reason why there is currently no shortage of ESL teachers in Austin, where more than 27% of the city's 75,000 students are learning English. Jackie Leroy is head of ESL programs for Syracuse City School District in New York. She said when she started working there 22 years ago, 5% of students were ESL learners. Now, more than 18% of the city's students are English learners. She said that even though job applications have slowed lately, the city has been very active in recruiting teachers. She also said many students that have gone through Syracuse's ESL program later return as teachers. English learners are among the students who have struggled the most during the pandemic, school district officials say. Edwards, with Austin Schools, said a large percentage of the city's ESL students were not faring well during the early part of the pandemic. A larger percent had failing grades, she said. Learning and studying in a home where English was not the main language spoken proved to be very hard for many students. Some parents of ESL students had difficulty communicating with teachers and understanding what learning materials their children needed. If they're in their home the whole time, and there's no one that speaks English, and all their assignments are in English, how do they get that extra support? Leroy said. Edwards said ESL students in Austin have greatly benefited from the return to in-person classes. Students are now able to have a full day of classes, and the district has started providing small group instruction. But it is largely unknown how many students are behind in their English and academic progress, said the researcher Villegas. There is not enough data to know for sure. In Texas, for example, there was a statewide test to measure performance, but the test was not required for all students. English learners, many of whom come from immigrant families, also faced difficulties at home. In Texas, some immigrant families were unable to receive pandemic aid and feared looking for health insurance because they are undocumented, Benson said. Some students needed to get jobs to provide extra money for their families. The pandemic as a whole has added so many challenges, Benson said. But they face additional challenges that are out of their control. I'm Dan Novak.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation. Early in 1857, the United States Supreme Court announced one of its most important rulings. The High Court decided the case of a slave named Dred Scott. Harry Monroe and Leo Scully tell us about the ruling and the continuing national debate over slavery.
Dred Scott lived in Missouri, where slavery was legal. Then he was sold to a man who took him to Illinois and Wisconsin, where slavery was not legal. After 4 years, he was returned to Missouri. Dred Scott demanded his freedom because of the years he had spent in places where slavery was illegal. Congress had banned slavery in those places under the Missouri Compromise Act of 1820. The Supreme Court ruled that Congress did not have the power to close territories to slavery. It said the Missouri Compromise was a violation of the United States Constitution, and that Dred Scott was not a free man.
James Buchanan was sworn in as president at the time of the Dred Scott case. Buchanan believed the Supreme Court's decision would put an end to the dispute over slavery. He believed that Americans, North and South, would accept the decision as the final word in the dispute. This did not happen. The Dred Scott decision did not calm the storm that divided the nation. Instead, it increased its fury.
New trouble threatened to break out in the territory of Kansas between pro-slavery and anti-slavery settlers. In the past few years, the two sides had argued and fought over their opinions. They even had formed two separate governments. The pro-slavery forces controlled the legal government. The anti-slavery forces controlled an opposition government which had no power. Supporters of slavery wanted to organize a constitutional convention that could put Kansas into the Union as a slave state. The pro-slavery legislature passed a bill calling for such a convention. The bill gave supporters of slavery every chance to control the election of delegates to the convention, and it gave the convention complete freedom to make its own rules. The bill provided no way for the people of Kansas to vote on their own constitution.
The governor of the Kansas Territory, John Geary, vetoed the bill. But the legislature quickly overruled his veto. Pro-slavery men called for Geary to get out of Kansas. Some talked of shooting him if he did not leave. Governor Geary had been living under extreme tension for months. He had worked hard to keep Kansas peaceful. He was angry because he could get no help from the federal government. He sent his resignation to President Buchanan. Then the former governor spoke publicly. He said most of the settlers in Kansas were peace-loving people. He said only a small group was responsible for the trouble there. Geary said a few powerful men hoped to make Kansas a slave state. If this failed, Geary said, they hoped their actions would produce civil war.
President Buchanan appointed a new governor for Kansas. Buchanan told him that slavery in the territory must be decided on the votes of the people of the territory. And he said the people must be given a fair chance to approve or reject a constitution for statehood. The new governor arrived in Kansas at the end of May 1857. He explained his policies in a speech to the people of Kansas. The new governor promised to enforce the laws of the pro-slavery legislature, but only those laws which were constitutional. He urged everyone to vote in the coming election of delegates to the Constitutional Convention. He said he was hopeful that the convention would offer its constitution to the people for their approval or rejection. He added that Congress would not accept Kansas as a slave state or a free state until the people had voted on the question of slavery.
On June 15th, the election was held for delegates to the Constitutional Convention. Most anti-slavery men did not vote because their names had been kept off the voting lists by pro-slavery officials. Others refused to vote because they believed the election was unfair. 60 delegates were elected. All supported slavery. They planned to meet in the autumn to begin work on a constitution for Kansas. Most of the delegates were wild, rough men who found it difficult to read and write. But these men were sure of one thing. They wanted Kansas to be a slave state.
The delegates began the Constitution by claiming that the right of property was higher than any constitutional power. They said a slave owner had as much right to his property as the owner of any other kind of property. Then they wrote the different parts of the document. One part of the Constitution severely limited the right of the legislature to free slaves. Another part barred free Negroes from entering Kansas. And another prevented the Constitution from being changed for 7 years.
Most of the delegates to the Kansas Constitutional Convention wanted to send the document directly to Congress for approval. They did not want to give the people of Kansas a chance to vote on it. They were sure that the majority of the population would reject a constitution that made slavery legal. Some delegates, however, knew that Congress would not approve statehood for Kansas unless the people voted on the Constitution. The two sides finally agreed on a compromise.
The Constitution itself would not be offered to the people. Instead, the people would vote only on the question of slavery. They could vote for the Constitution with slavery, or the Constitution without slavery. If the voters approved the Constitution with slavery, then Kansas would be open to new slaves. If they approved the Constitution without slavery, then Kansas would be closed to new slaves. Slaves already in the territory could be kept there. This compromise brought a cry of anger from opponents of slavery in Kansas. They said the Constitutional Convention had only given them the right to vote for limited slavery or unlimited slavery. It had not given them the right to vote for freedom.
President Buchanan had promised the people of Kansas that they would have a fair chance to vote on their Constitution. But members of his cabinet told him to forget this promise. They said Americans were tired of the dispute in Kansas and would accept any settlement. They told Buchanan that approval of the Constitution would end the Kansas problem. It would satisfy the South, they said, and the North would soon forget about Kansas. Under this pressure, President Buchanan made his decision. He would ask Congress to accept the pro-slavery Kansas Constitution and make the territory a slave state.
In Kansas, the vote on slavery was held. Most opponents of slavery did not vote. They were waiting until they could vote against the complete statehood constitution. Many of the votes were illegal. Still, Kansas officials declared that slavery had been approved. They urged Congress to make Kansas a state under this condition. Shortly after, President Buchanan sent Congress a similar message. Buchanan's chief opponent on the statehood bill was a member of his own Democratic Party, Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois. Douglas did not oppose slavery, but he believed that the people of a territory had the right to make their own decision to accept or reject slavery.
Stephen Douglas united other Democrats and members of the anti-slavery Republican Party to fight against the bill in the Senate. He lost. The Senate approved the bill to make Kansas a state where slavery was legal. The House of Representatives, however, rejected the bill. Instead, it approved a bill to let the people of Kansas vote again on their statehood constitution. The Senate approved a compromise version of this House bill.
So the people of Kansas got another chance to show that they did not want a pro-slavery constitution. They voted and rejected the Constitution by a large majority. The pro-slavery statehood constitution was dead. Kansas would continue as a territory for a few more years. But there would be no further attempt to make it a slave state.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.